Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Lainey.
Hey, it's Joanna.
And welcome to Show Your Work.
So the coming year is the year of the
pig.
Right. You've taken it upon yourself to inform everybody about their Chinese zodiac. Today is Monday when we're recording this. Mm-hmm. And so today you had the rat.
Correct.
And tomorrow, Tuesday, or yesterday, if you're listening to this on Wednesday, is the ox. Is that right?
Yeah.
So am I right in understanding that you're laying them out? How do you choose how to lay them out on which day?
Well, there is a specific order, mm-hmm. and typically the order starts with the rat and ends with the pig. So we just happen to be in a year where it lines up with how the signs are represented and the order in which they always come. Don't ask me how the order was decided. I don't know how the order was decided, but...
Wait, I don't understand, because there's a zodiac, there's the 12,
yep.
and we know that there's a sequence there, right?
Yes.
Like every 12 years.
There's a sequence and one follows the other, right?
Right.
Rat is followed by ox, is followed by tiger, is followed by rabbit, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Now, that has always been, like, rat is the first sign of the zodiac. Not that first is most important, it's just the order.
It's just what you, it's January.
That's right.
It's what
just
you start
in
with.
The Western zodiac, you start with January, whatever the sign is, like, Capricorn, Sagittarius, whatever it is.
I think it always starts with Aries or Aquarius maybe. Yeah. Anyway.
I don't have those memorized.
Right.
I only have the Chinese ones memorized. So it just so happens that this year falls where I am starting with rat because I need to end with pig.
Got it. Because any other year you would want to end with the year of whatever that was.
That's right.
Got it.
But next year, mm-hmm. I will end with rat,
mm-hmm.
and start with ox.
Right.
Next
I get
year
it.
Is the year of the rat.
Yeah. So it just starts where it starts.
Correct.
But the thing is, as I've learned from you, you are an ox.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
And I am a goat. So that's six signs away from you, right?
It's the exact opposite.
That's right. Like it's up is down. It's east is west. It's the opposite pole almost.
Yes.
But you know, if I understand correctly, like you're working with your ma, who's a feng shui scholar.
Yeah.
But you already have all this information. So you know what's going to happen to me and I don't get to know for like six more days. Is that what's going on here?
I actually don't. So when she, some people might know, she hasn't been feeling well. And so her readings to me have been a little bit delayed this year. And even when she's not sick, she takes her time. And so like when she's doing her studying, she might spend an entire day or half a day on rats and then another half a day. And so she gives them to me in batches. So right now I only know, as of this recording, I only know rat, ox, tiger, and rabbit, which happens to be the four signs representing my family. Yasik is a rabbit, I'm an ox, Ma is a tiger, and Dad's a rat. And then in a couple days, we have another scheduled phone call when she has the energy, because
mm-hmm.
like it's an hour phone call.
Of course.
And she'll have the energy to relay to me like two more or three more. And then
I'll
roll
them out.
But
only in the specific order, because she would never deviate.
Yeah, she would never deviate. No.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So now that you've been doing this for this long, mm-hmm. like what happens now? Do people pester you? Do they try to get you to like interpret things better than they're laid out online?
Yes.
Tell me about the emails you're getting.
They get really specific. Like, I'm a rat. Thanks for, you know, telling me about it. But this year I'm planning this. Is it a good idea for me to plan this? And it's on this day. And should I be doing it on this day? Can you ask your ma? So they really want it drilled down.
Of course.
Yeah.
If you're going to, of course you do. If you're going to do this and buy into this, and I definitely have a friend who was calculating, you will love this, every possible birth date for their upcoming child. Like, you know, they have the due date, But it's like, well, if it's between 7 and 9 in the morning, it's going to have like a rat rising or whatever it was. Like, people want as much of a decode as they can.
Yes.
And so do you just frustrate them?
It's not that I'm deliberately frustrating them. It's I actually can't get back to that many people. And also, Ma can't drill down either, in the sense of, if you need to drill down, if you go to a legitimate feng shui master and need it drilled down, you have to give your hour of birth, your spouse's hour of birth, if you have a spouse, your parents' hour of birth, the location of birth. I mean, there are all kinds of things that need to be like understood and processed before you get those drilled down answers.
Right. But okay, but now let's pretend we're not doing the podcast. Like, you're going to call me and tell me what she says, right? So I can prep before the entire world knows about what's going to happen to me.
I will let you know. Like, for example, she hasn't gotten to here I can give people like an advance.
Oh my God,
but only,
guys.
But this only matters to people who are dragons. So she obviously takes a quick peek, like a spoiler alert for herself, for people she cares about.
Of course.
And so she loves my best friend Fiona, and Fiona and her husband Q are both dragons.
Uh-huh.
Dragons were the worst sign last year, or the year that's ending. In the year of the dog, dragons had it shit.
Right.
And because they're both dragons, they were in a double dragon fuck shit situation.
Oh my God, double dragon is a real thing?
It was fucked bad. And they had a rough year.
Mm-hmm.
However, this year, during the year of the pig, the pig is so lucky for dragons that Fiona and Q are like in for some greatness. And so she told me right away. She was like, tell Fiona and Q they're gonna be great.
Great.
Yeah.
And we know she doesn't tell people to prepare for happy. So that's
right.
That's extra
special. She cares
special.
About Fiona and Q. And specifically, dragons are like pretty good, but the fact that Fiona and Q are double dragons
means double good in all the ways.
There's a saying, actually, "Liang Long Chu Hai," which is two dragons sail the seas.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay,
it's an expression.
Right.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I could just go on and do this. I think we maybe did do this last year around this time.
Every year, Duana, every year you are up my ass for this.
Well, because I want to know, and because I am a Leo. That's my other astrological sign.
Yeah.
And reading things to do with Leo is like a Bible. I'm one of those people who's really into the Instagram accounts that like have memes based on your on your astrological sign.
Yeah.
Not all Geminis. Not that you guys need me to tell you that, because I'm sure they're hugely, hugely famous. But every single post about a Leo is God's honest truth. I'm just like, yeah, that's accurate in every way. So I'm looking for, you know, I like to know more about me, which I think is also a Leo trait. So yeah, I'm always anxious. I'm always waiting to know.
Stay tuned.
Here we go.
You're coming up, I guess, in 6 after the ox.
That's right. So it's going to be not till like next Wednesday. I'm keeping track. I know what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, did I usurp your preamble? Did you have something you wanted to talk about?
I did not. Oh, actually, I do. Now, before we move on, I just wanted to give everybody an update on Abraham.
Oh.
Thank you all for your notes about Abraham. As I put on my Insta story a few days ago, I'm a bit worried about Abraham because he's doing like a hard lean.
Right.
And you saw him last week. He was fine.
Yeah. For the uninitiated, or if you skip around, depending on the podcast topic, Abraham is
your
plant who was bestowed on you by elves who belong to Michelle Obama. Yes. We named him last week.
You named him.
I did. Yes. And I felt very happy about that. Yeah, he is doing a real limbo.
Yeah. So I'm quite worried about Abraham. As you said last week, you've never seen me this concerned, only about my dogs and now about Abraham. And Yasik now thinks – so a lot of people on Instagram were like, it's because he's trying to reach the sun. It's not that. I rotate Abraham all the time. But Yasik thinks he doesn't have enough soil.
I don't know if that's a thing.
Well, I'm confused because in his packaging, it says that he should like stay in his cube for a year. And then after a year, you plant him and the entire cube into like outside in your yard and you're good to go.
Yeah. I mean, I assume you're watering him enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mark the watering days on my calendar and I'm very specific. Like I use measuring spoons to water him.
I can't. Okay. All right. Well, it is the fucking coldest it can possibly be where we live right now. You will hear the heat going on and off because we are too cold to deal with sitting here for your audio enjoyment to sit here without heat. And you proposed that maybe he was cold.
I thought maybe he, because he's close to the window.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, with these temperatures and they're very sensitive beings.
Maybe you need to try like a Charlie Brown style, like wrap him in a scarf, like it's the Christmas tree.
Maybe, because I don't want to put him by a heater. Anyway, I just thank you all for caring about Abraham. I am worried about him, but hopefully he'll rally. And one last thing, because I know you'll be interested in this. We talked about you christening Abraham. Mm-hmm. Did you know that in olden Chinese days, like not that old, because this happened to me, when a couple has a child, it is tradition in many families to bring the child over to an elder, like a parent, a grandparent.
Right.
And it's the grandparent who names the child.
So I have heard this, actually, because I, as you may know, you know, I dabble in a name story and
just
lore.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit. But yeah, I did know that, and in other cultures as well. I think in a lot of Indian and Sri Lankan cultures, similar processes happened.
I was named by my father's father.
Okay.
My Chinese name came from my father's father, and my father's father, my grandfather, made up my name or like picked my name.
Created it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't a created. I don't want people to think it was one of those like Madalemelies, you know, that, you know.
No, I understand that your Chinese name is not the equivalent of Kinsley. We got that.
Yes. So my grandfather decided on my name based on my mother's name.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother's Chinese name is Fong, and my Chinese name is Fun, and Fun Fong together means fragrant.
Okay.
Yeah. It's to denote a flower. Anyway, I'm just saying you are an elder.
Right.
And I should have said it last week when you properly christened Abe, but yes, you are like an elder in certain cultures where people bring plants and babies to you and say, please name the child.
I mean, I'm so caught between loving that and like the genuine loveliness that is that for you to say that. And also just like side-eyeing that you called me an elder after saying this was an olden day custom.
Or a throwback. You're a throwback.
All of the above. I will take it. I bring me your huddled children, plants, and others. I haven't gotten a car in a while. Nobody's asked me to name a car in a long while. And that's something where I feel I could dig in more. There's definitely a type of person who names their car, you know?
Yes.
And maybe it's just not the time right now. But yeah, send me your car names. Let's see what we name them.
All right, shall we?
Okay, let's go.
Let's talk about what a lot of people are talking about. That is the Fyre Festival documentaries. Hulu did one and Netflix did one.
Right. But I have to assume that you and I watched the same one because Hulu is not available in Canada unless you're being shady with your VPN and your whatnot.
Yep.
So the Netflix documentary is the one that we and pretty much anybody else in Canada is going to be talking about.
And anybody I know, and you too, based on the way you walked in to the door today, like within 5 minutes of watching this is like, holy fucking shit, what the fuck is this?
I was watching on my laptop before I left my house today and I'm sitting on the stairs waiting for the Uber because, you know, I wasn't going to drive over here in 6 feet of snow. It's not really 6 feet, but it may as well be. And my husband was like, okay, bye, what is this? And was standing over me on the stairs while I sat there watching going, are they serious right now?
Yeah.
Like it's amazing. It's we definitely don't rewatch with one another, and yet I know this will be a go back and rewatch immediately.
It's, as we say in our business, good TV.
Not just because of the train wreck situation. It is well produced and well told. The best parts of documentary, you know, documentaries have scripts, right? Like, they are stories that are told and crafted, often in the edit suite instead of on the page beforehand. But it's well, well done.
It's really well done. Again, it's good TV. It's well done. And that, I guess, is the irony. It is good work about not good work. And you are closing your eyes right now, like, as if in pain.
It's shocking. It's shocking for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. And the first shock for me was that if you've seen the documentary, which of course you have, a lot of the footage that you're watching, especially early on in the planning processes for Firefest, is like documentary footage that they were making themselves ostensibly for what they thought would be like the triumphant DVD, like the making of Firefest or Firefest Origins or whatever they thought they were doing.
That's right.
Like, it's happening in real time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just can't believe that these people were essentially filming their own demise is what kills me.
And that's, like, there is no film that is good work. We've established it's good TV. It's good show your work. There is no film without this footage.
That's right.
And there's a series of ironic shades here, in a sense. Like,
you mean, like, had they not had the hubris or the grandioseness to film themselves doing this, then the story of Firefest, which we all kind of heard about, would just be like a footnote on Deadspin or something.
It may be the only thing they did right, not in the original intended form of, you know, what they were hoping for the footage.
Well, right for us, yes. Like, for our enjoyment.
That's right. It might be the only thing that they did right. And by they, I mean, like, Fire Media, or what was Fire Media.
I don't. Okay, so I think we should break this down a little bit because, wow, there's so many things. First of all, my first big surprise in watching this doc was that, and it makes sense perfectly now, but it was so, the reporting of the story was so clustered and there was so much about, like, there's no food and there's no whatever, that it was lost on me that Firefest, the event, mm-hmm. was actually a massive marketing scheme for
Fire Media.
Was meant to be the Uber of booking celebrities.
That's right.
So this whole thing starts because people want bigger access to celebrities.
Yeah.
Or investors thought, hey, people would like bigger access to celebrities.
That's right. Like, I totally agree with you. I don't think that in, as you said, the reporting of this in 2017, where we all heard about this busted festival and we saw the Instagram photos of, like, the cheese sandwich, and we were, like, watching it unfold. People couldn't get off the island, and they had nowhere to go to the bathroom, and they were, like, the tents were all, like, fucked up. It was so, nobody at that moment, or not nobody, but a lot of people who consumed media, like us, I mean, I'd like to say we're pretty with it for those kinds of stories.
Look, everybody who wasn't reporting the story.
Yeah. When we were consuming it, it was like, oh my God, these people tried to be Coachella and failed. There was no, this Coachella or this music festival was in service of starting this app, this, you know, this tool, so that, you know, the next time you have a conference for your company and you want to book a keynote, you can call up or you can use this app and you can find out the rate for, I don't fucking know, like, whatever, P. Diddy.
Sure.
Sure.
Creed. Yeah, whomever.
Yeah.
But that was the business model.
That's right. So obviously, like, number one, does this mean from the very beginning when they had a very successful launch with the promo video,
mm-hmm.
even though they kept talking about how successful the announcement of the festival was with all those influencers and the models posting their pictures at the same time, is it a success when no one really knows that this party that you're throwing is actually in service of a bigger idea?
I mean, I don't know if that was a secret. I don't know if they were trying to hide that it was, you know, that this will be the kickoff to this app. But the thing is that the dude had a pedigree. So the guy in question, the mm-hmm. mastermind, the greatest con ever pulled, I guess, or don't sue me, whichever.
The greatest millennial con. How about that?
Oh, people are going to come for you. And also, I have to say, I'm obligated to say millennials are 40. Depending on which metric you use, the oldest millennials are either 37 or 40. And ergo, I don't think you're always talking about millennials when you're talking about misguided young people. However,
mm-hmm.
so Billy McFarlane is his name. And the thing is that this guy had a bit of a pedigree. I don't remember. Do you remember the name of the previous
like Magnesis or something like that? Like, yeah.
He created a metal credit card that was actually a pass to a high-end club, like a Soho House, like a something.
I don't think it's Magnesis, but it's something M.
Like it did very well for him. Yeah. And investors were like, okay, this guy can do this stuff. He can scare up the kids. He knows how to get them.
On the surface, it was doing well.
Yeah. And that's my other favorite thing is that throughout this documentary, when they talk about the guests who are coming to Firefest, they call them kids uniformly the whole way through. It's amazing.
Yes. The guests, the people who've bought the tickets, the wristbands, whatever. Yes. They're called kids.
It was the best.
So you're right. He, Billy McFarlane, had started that credit card company. And it was like a membership club where you got to have wine tastings and parties. And on the surface, for sure, it looked legit. As we find out in the documentary, it was full of holes and about to implode anyway.
You don't say.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you watch the documentary. You watch the carnage happening. You know, the people, especially the people in the Bahamas, in the islands, who are like, this was never going to happen, but everybody was working. Like, what were you going to do?
Yeah.
It's all rolling out. Various horrors unfold.
Mm-hmm.
What was the biggest, what surprised you the most?
Look, I was taking mental notes throughout my watching of it because I thought, this is show your work or not show your work. And one of the takeaways I wanted to raise with you is the ignoring of expert advice. And that is, I mean, listen, experts are experts for a reason. And this goes up and down across all industries. I thought about the connections here between even with the explosion of lifestyle and wellness services and products that are put out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm going to say what you won't say. You're talking about Goop.
Yeah.
Right.
And
that half the things that are recommended on Goop, endorsed by Gwyneth, are by definition bunk.
Right.
But when confronted with that, she's just like,
That's right. And the thing is, there are experts, as in science, researchers.
Right. Sure.
Medical professionals who've done this for a long time, who are dealing with up-to-date science, who are saying, like, hey, there is no legitimate, researched, proven link between X and Y, so taking this is actually not proven to work.
Right.
So it made me think about all the connections out there beyond Fyre Festival where experts are ignored and how we get to a point where we ignore experts. Now, in the case of lifestyle, it's because, sure, there are some people who have been disappointed by certain industries, by doctors, by researchers who aren't hearing their concerns. That is, I get it for sure. And that is a conversation we can have. But
and that's something actually that Dr. Jen Gunter, who's one of Gwyneth Paltrow's biggest detractors.
Yes.
That's something she says a lot. She's like, this is bunk science, but is happening because people have been so disillusioned by the traditional medical industry that they're looking for something else.
And she's saying, as she has said before, like, I'm working with my colleagues. We want to improve that relationship. And but we're saying that like it's not going to get better if you're pursuing these alternative measures. So that's one thing on the expert. But the other thing on the expertise thing is these are people that you've brought in, going back to Fyre Festival now, you've brought in to ask them about their experience. You've been to this place before. You've done these things before. You've flown the routes before. You've landscaped the territory before. When someone tells you, you need water, you need you need this much square footage to put this many like temporary residential structures, how you can just be like, nah, see you later. I don't get it.
Well, here's why I looked at you with an asterisk in my eyes when you said experts, is because everybody who is quoted in this documentary, well, that's not fair. The doc is filled with two kinds of people. Largely inexperienced young people,
mm-hmm.
the vast majority of whom seem like they were doing their goddamn best.
They sure were.
I ran into a thing where, you know, I missed a couple of supers right early on and then I didn't catch up. So I only know them by their descriptions.
Yeah.
Like, you know, green stripy shirt attender guy
yeah.
and white t-shirt guy who
yes.
like whose heart broke, etc. But there are a lot of young, inexperienced people who mm-hmm. freely say, I've never done anything on this scale before.
I've never booked talent before.
That's right. That guy, I think the talent booker was 23.
He was 23 years old.
Look, I booked talent at 23.
Yeah.
Not for something this size, not
yeah.
to begin with anyway. And it is a bloody roller coaster of heart fear every day.
Yes.
And that's when you're doing something legitimate.
Yes.
That's when you're booking for national television mm-hmm. programs that are legitimate and verifiable, and it's still a nightmare.
Correct.
And then the other people he's surrounded
yes.
by are sycophants. There are some people who are more experienced, mm-hmm. who have been there before. The people who are writing the checks, who say more than once, okay, Billy. Yes, Billy.
You're such a visionary.
Sure. You whatever you want.
Great idea.
The moment that really made me go, oh, this was a case of mass hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
You know the moment. You know the one I'm talking about,
yeah.
right? So there's a scene where we learned that all the water for the festival is being held up at customs, at Bahamian customs. And I actually can't believe I'm even telling you this. I can't believe it wasn't a fever dream of my own. But Billy calls his kind of advisor slash consigliere, like that guy
yeah.
was, he even said he's sort of a self-appointed right-hand man
yeah.
slash counsel or whatever. His name is Andy. And he says to this guy, and we know this because Andy is the one telling us, he says, you know what, I need you to go to customs and perform oral sex on the head of customs to get this fixed. And Andy takes some pauses like I'm taking right now. And he says, I went home and I took a shower. And you're waiting for Andy to say, and then I drove over to Billy.
And told him to fuck himself.
I kicked the shit out of him.
yeah.
I, whatever, I called the cops. That's not what he says.
No.
He says, I went home, I took a shower, and then I brushed my teeth.
yeah.
And you realize that he's talking about preparing to do this.
Yeah.
Preparing to
suck off the customs official.
Which, look, please don't make any mistake. I'm not sex shaming anybody or talking about anything to do with anything you want to do in your own time. But the idea that somebody who is, you just said, an expert,
mm-hmm.
the idea that somebody who is an expert at throwing events, at doing these kind of things goes, yeah, that's a reasonable way to get around this, and then tells a documentary about it.
Yep.
I cannot wrap my head around that.
No.
And I cannot in good faith call that guy an expert. I can't.
Not anymore. I mean, his expert credentials certainly should be revoked. Or, I mean, as you said, not sex shaming. I mean, the request was asked of him. And yes, However, my point about experts is that Andy had tried to help and was throwing everything he had on his resume, anything that he had ever accumulated in terms of knowledge and best practices and hacks and tips and tricks that he had gathered and put in his toolbox over the course of all his years of work, he had thrown them at this problem already. And it was insurmountable because this was not set up to succeed. It was set up to fail. And so Andy, I have sympathy for Andy. Andy was like, well, shit, I have used up everything I know. And now this kid who I've had success with before and who, frankly, other people are pouring money into needs me to do this one thing. Like, yeah, it's a fever dream. And yeah, like, you know, it's probably a little bit of like trauma, hypnosis or something that he thought that was his only light. It's fucking crazy. I agree. But this is what these people turn these experts into. That's also another like an issue here.
You know, there's a line somewhere kind of midway through the documentary where it says, oh, it was a nightmare in the days leading up, but it's always a nightmare in the days leading up to an event. And I have done countless events.
It really is.
And so have you. And yeah. It's so true. There are always things that are impossible. There are flights that are canceled. There are, I don't know, you don't have the rights to the music at the last minute and it's Sunday and you can't call the office to get them or all the things.
You're right. There's a great line in Shakespeare in Love when Geoffrey Rush's character, I know like he's canceled, but his character, he repeats this thing where they say to him like, is it going to turn out? And he's like, yes. And they say, how? And he says, I don't know. It's a mystery.
Right.
Like, and it's one of those things.
Yeah. It's a known thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be a disaster leading up to it. Tempers run high. And things fall apart, and somehow it comes together, unless you're the Oscars 2 years ago or whatever.
Right.
But I can see where knowing that, having been through, you know, events that look like they're going to fall apart at the last second and then seeing them all come together, I can see where maybe you would override some of your...
Yeah.
And I really got to shout one out to my boy in the white T-shirt, whose name I also didn't get.
With the ponytail, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who,
I can't remember his name right now either, but I know who
you mean. Who was faithfully emailing going, we do not have places for these people to sleep. We do not have beds. What are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
He was trying.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, well, they'll see you doing yoga.
Yeah.
That was the response.
Well, first he was told, stop sending these emails to the money.
That's correct. Yeah. Don't upset the partners, the investors.
Which is the other thing I wanted to bring up. The investors. Specifically the woman, Carola.
That's right. I thought it was like the brand at first, but no, I think that's actually her name.
Yes. Yeah. And she is, listen, I'm eyeballing her. She clearly is a very wealthy person to be able to continue, like, you know, supplementing this.
Right.
And I'm eyeballing her at what, like 45?
Maybe younger. Yeah.
Okay. So a big sister-y person?
To him?
Yeah.
Sure. And maybe like, you know, not knowing a thing about where the money that she has came from, maybe seeing an opportunity to grow more, right? Create her own personal fortune.
So that's also what I want to talk about. What's that?
Oh, well, I mean, look, like everybody.
Because we're talking about different levels and layers of work here. As you talked about, there are the juniors, the, you know, novices who've just come into the business. We talked about experts, the investors. We don't get too much of the money here, like, but she's in several scenes, and she's there at the table when Billy's like, we're going to need a little bit more money and we can do this to make it back, VIP, I don't know, whatever experiences. And she's like, yeah. And she believed.
Sure. And who knows, you know, the way it was edited. Like in that scene, he says, can we have $3 or $5 more million?
Yeah.
And she kind of is like, meh, sure.
Yeah.
Like that's change, right?
Exactly. So, what is that in terms of investment?
Well, I've talked before on this show about the way that pilots for television shows are made, right? And this is also the way that movies are made on a different level. Movies are changing a little bit, but basically, there's an investment made in products, in pilots, or in films, knowing that not all of them are going to make their money back, right? In order to be a financier of any type of this product, you assume that some are going to go well and others are not going to go well. And the ones that do well, you hope, are going to do well enough that they cover your losses and net you a profit. You're essentially a gambler when you're banking on anything in entertainment, right?
Yeah.
We don't have as much legwork in music, but I assume it's the same thing. You sign an artist, you give them a small advance, and you hope that they earn it back tenfold.
Yeah.
So if you are, let's call her a venture capitalist, let's say, or an aspiring venture capitalist, you have to assume that this is, if it's a gamble,
yeah,
that it's going to work. Or that if it doesn't work, that, you know, it's going to be a modest failure, right? Nobody could have predicted this.
Right.
Or maybe they could. You know, I'm obsessed with a podcast called The Pitch. It's one of those Gimlet pitches. It's like a Dragon's Den or a Shark Tank, but they're pitching to real investors who obviously often go ahead.
Sure.
But what happens on that show, I would say a good 60% of the time, is that after the, yes, yay, I'll give you money, there's a little after note where it says, well, it kind of fell apart in due diligence.
Yeah.
Due diligence.
Sure.
Is the key here.
Due diligence.
Right.
I mean, I guess one of the things that reminded me of is I was watching a few weeks ago, there was a John F. Kennedy Jr. special on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were talking, it was like the last days of his life.
Uh-huh.
And so beyond, you know, the gossip about Carolyn and all that, they were focusing as well on how his magazine, George, was doing.
Right, which was, I believe, not that well by the end.
It wasn't doing that well by the end. And he was, they say, according to the people who were talking on this documentary or this feature on him, they said that he was stressed out about it. And he was going and flying to Toronto at one point to meet with an investor. That investor actually went on camera and talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
How he said one day John flew to Toronto to see me, like, and he made a point of saying JFK Jr. coming from New York, flying in to see me. Like, I knew that there was this, like, a situation and he needed my help.
Right.
And then, like, another investor, or at least the publisher, I think, was on camera talking about how the magazine just wasn't selling, and it was the tone of the magazine, right? Like, a lot of it had to do with the editorial tone. Anyway, that's another podcast altogether about JFK Jr. But this is John F. Kennedy Jr. with his name and his name.
Well, and his, but aside from the name, he had charm, he had clout,
yes,
he knew everybody there was to know, right?
And he was, you know, capable in a way beyond charm as well, articulate, all that. And even he had to be like going to see these people and showing them the storyboards and showing them the business plan and giving him his vision, specific business plan visions.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like what we were fucking seeing there in the documentary that Billy was doing, where, you know, he looks like he's on his way to play beach volleyball and stops in to talk to this person and is like, well, I can, you know, we can think up some more VIP packages and they can do this and cabanas and whatever. And then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, here. Because let me be clear, the point I'm trying to make about JFK Jr. was he was turned down repeatedly.
Right, because the people who were would-be investors were doing their due diligence, right? They look at him, they look at all the clout, the charm, the plans, the this, the that, and they go, I just don't see it. I just don't see it here.
Yeah.
And it's worth remembering that we're talking about the investor's due diligence. That's on them to check it out,
right? That's their work.
That's their work. You have to check and make sure that the people are who they say they are, that their sales are what they say they are.
Yeah.
In order to come to a place where you're like, yeah, this is a sound place to put my money. Because, of course, they have to answer to their own investors or don't, or like, whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
So that's those people who were not doing their due diligence, right? And to be fair, I don't think she was his only investor. I think there were several. But it's very clear from, once again, lawyer guy, a guy who was like, I started a Twitter feed and nobody cared, so I just started digging, that I don't think that his mistakes and his paperings over were very far below the surface.
No, and I think that I think is a good segue to influencer culture.
Well, this is where it comes. Yes, exactly.
And to take it back to JFK Jr., he was JFK Jr. and in his time could also be called an influencer. I mean, that's who you want, right? Like everybody wanted him at their party.
Yeah, they called them names back
then.
That's
right.
Right?
Exactly.
Oh my God, back then. But yeah, that's what you said. Like
names.
Bold-faced
names. So there's in that documentary or that show that I watched at the beginning of the year, it was talked about that you always wanted JFK Jr. to show up in New York if you were having an event. If you were having an event and he like walked through the door, immediately it was a success. And he used his own clout to start his business. And the people who invested initially in that business were investing in his influence.
That's right.
Right.
Knowing that he's
right.
influential. He's
correct.
He's got sway.
Yes.
He can absolutely have an impact on the buying habits or subscribing habits of desirable people.
20, 25 years later, as you pointed out, the name has changed. It's influencers now, social media influencers. Billy, may have been a CEO eventually, but at the beginning, he was an influencer. He was somebody in the city who decided to bring influencers together, thereby becoming an influencer himself. And that's actually how he got meetings with all these people and got people to believe in him, because he became one of the biggest influencers.
And also the Maserati. Don't forget.
Correct.
That we were told,
yes.
his private jets and his Maseratis were
that's right.
part of the image that leads
right.
you to influence.
So now you have an event led by an influencer, relying on other influencers to promote, hoping that influencers would come too.
Right.
Yes.
And this is where we get to why this all went down. Because look, there are successful, legitimate people who have failures, right? Like Oprah has had ventures that don't go. Shonda Rhimes has had shows that fail. But Spielberg has had flops. Like that's, you
yes.
can't.
Failure is a big part of this podcast. We've talked about it a lot.
Yeah. And you can't insure against it, even if you have a hit machine on your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Now is the time for you to chime in with some sports thing about how even Michael Jordan had an off day or something, right? Like there's no insurance.
No.
But the reason that this didn't all fizzle 5 weeks beforehand is because even though, there's that great segment where they're deleting all the comments on social media of where do I go?
Yeah.
What airport? How do I do this? Talk to us.
Yeah.
Even though all those people had those questions, they still went because the promise of what they were going to wasn't just glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just exciting. It was anointed. You are chosen.
Yes. You would be able to say you were there as part of the first.
And not just you were there because, you heard a word or like through the grapevine, because you were selected because you yourself are so important. You are such a big deal that we want you to be at this big, big deal thing.
Mm-hmm.
That is crack cocaine.
Yep.
I mean, how do you say no to that? A lot of people don't. There are many events happening on lower scales than this all the time that people go to. And sometimes they're great. And sometimes they're not that great. You kind of go, that was annoying. But that is absolutely the lure that cannot be ignored.
No. And again, you can argue that the payoff of that allure is that in the job of being an influencer, you use that to build your following so that you can find more clients, that you can find more opportunities.
It's
so,
content and it boosts your profile and all the rest of it.
In the aftermath of FIRE immediately in 2017, there was a sense among a lot of people who were watching this go up in flames that there was a little schadenfreude there, right? Like, haha, these are all rich people. Remember, like, the headlines were some people paid as much as $100,000 to go. And if you're like a person, a layperson watching this go down online, yeah, the there was a common reaction like, well, fuck, who the fuck is $100,000 to attend a party? There wasn't that much sympathy, I will say. There wasn't that much sympathy for the people who got ripped off. I do think that one of the perhaps secondary or tertiary like accomplishments of this Netflix documentary was it did make me feel a little bit bad for the people who got conned. Certainly there were some who had like, you know, this, that, and the third junior, whatever estate name after the commas in their name, and they have the cash. But I will say that I did feel a certain sympathy for the disappointment that they must have had, particularly for those who are hustling as influencers, who were, as we talked about, counting on this to leverage more out of the career and the brand they're building on Instagram.
Oh, sure. And, you know, that's generous of you to even look at it from a business sense. I feel bad for all of them, like with my paltry whatever. Like, you know, when you go on vacation and something fucks up and it happens and things are fine, but you're stewing the whole time. This is ruining my vacation. This is whatever.
But you're still on vacation.
It's true.
Yeah.
But I was looking at those lines of people standing with nothing to do. And then, like, rooting for their suitcases in shipping containers.
Uh-huh.
And that's before they discovered that, like, some of the mattresses that weren't soaked had been pissed on.
Right.
Like, that's just a human level of, like, degradation that no matter how wealthy you are, it's like, that it's okay to say that sucks in that situation.
Sure. Like, certainly, of course, we all feel bad for Marianne. Like, period, the end, right? I'm just specifically talking about influencer culture because I know that there are people who either don't quite understand it or, there was some scoffing like, ha, these people just wanted to go to party and like, look what happened and, you know, how stupid. And I get that. Like, I'm not saying that like to have that reaction was wrong. I had it too at the beginning. I'm saying that what this documentary does is it fleshes out the reverberations of the like that irresponsible, like that fraudulent and irresponsible behavior on behalf of essentially the showrunners there. Certainly caused some pain that I could sympathize with.
Well, not only that, I mean, arguably
among influencers.
Well, arguably the greatest line in the whole thing is when they're talking about the rainstorm that happens that morning. And
of course,
some of the workers look at each other and say, well, now they won't get away with it. And what kills me, here's the schadenfreude of it all to me, is that if they had brought, I don't know, it, like, had they not brought such influencers with such reach and such, I don't know, like, inclinations to create content, maybe those people wouldn't have documented the story as precisely as they did. Like, it wasn't a little blip, the story. It was massive because of the influence of the influencers that they brought.
It was like irony upon irony upon irony again.
Like, if you hear about like a bad cruise where something terrible happens, it's like Joe and Marie from Chattanooga tell the local news what happened and then they go home. But because everybody who was there had their own followings, this became the most massive story of the implosion of terror.
But also, I think it may be, if you boil everything down, it may be the most basic of business stories or the most basic or common of business failure stories. And that is a problem of scale.
Mm-hmm. Too big, too fast.
That's right. And another example that we saw in this very recently, just this week, is the Caroline Calloway story.
Now, you told me about this because I didn't know, but on a micro level, it's essentially the same story.
It's a problem of scale. So we will link to this in the show notes. We don't have to get super into it right now, but Caroline Calloway is an Instagram influencer with 800,000 plus followers who wanted to do one of these like summits, you know, these tours.
like a day to learn about her and her brand and how to influence essentially and have her spirit.
That's right. And it hasn't gone very well. It's been documented at length and very precisely by Kaylee Donaldson for Pajiba. So we will link to that. Kaylee has done amazing work. Again, great work out of shitty work.
Absolutely.
Kaylee's great work came out of Caroline Calloway's not so great work. But the event didn't go so well. It was overwhelming for Caroline Calloway, which she was documenting in real time. On her Instagram, she was getting shipments of things, and she was like, oh my God, I have to store these mason jars here, and I'm trying to make salads in my house. An overpromise, an underdelivery, not unlike Fyre Festival. So, Duana, I guess to get closer to the conclusion of this discussion, what is the common ground here where it comes to influencer culture?
If I'm a big fan of, I don't know, Robert Downey Jr. as a performer, right? I don't want him to come to my house and make dinner because that's not what he does. One of the things that I keep coming back to is that, these influencers are influencing through a screen. And let's say they're making people very happy, right? Caroline Calloway did these sort of long text-based posts on her Instagram. That's how she grew her audience. Billy, as you say, was sort of his own, had his own brand and mystique that he was pushing. But to ask that person to then essentially do something like quantum physics, like why, I guess what I don't quite understand is why people want those people that they like following, and I follow people too, we all do, but I don't want Roxane Gay to clean my teeth.
Yeah.
Like, I want her to continue to do what I enjoy, which is write pithy things that make me think.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's one of those ideas of, like, overconsumption almost. Mm-hmm. Like, you like that person so much that you want to be near them and have everything they have and learn how they do it and be at a party that's exclusive for all of them. And it's like, well, that's not what they were selling you to begin with.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So why buy that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that's the part that I have
difficulty
with. I'm sure Roxane Gay would do a great job cleaning my teeth, but she wouldn't want to, and neither would I.
Yeah.
It's why buy something that they were never selling you in the first place is my first thing.
That's a good one.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Another thing that you touched on earlier in terms of experts, you know how they say, like, you don't regret the things you do, you regret the things you don't do?
Uh-huh.
I can think of an uncomfortable number of times where after something has gone kind of pear-shaped in my life, I've gone, perhaps I should have listened to that person who was like, this is not going to go the way you want it to go.
And I guess that's what's tricky is when to kick in the muscle that says I should do it because it's scary and I'm going to learn something.
Well, maybe that's something bigger here because we're constantly selling these messages on Instagram and everywhere else, right? If you get no, then keep trying. If you are told that you can't do it, then prove that you can. Keep pushing, keep going, keep whatever. Like, it's almost as though people's meters are broken in terms of, but I don't know, because I even think that's being too generous in terms of assuming that Billy McFarlane asked real known advisors who would tell him no. I'm not sure he asked that many people. I'm not sure he got that much advice.
You know what's tricky about this entire situation that's bigger than Fyre and is this whole the influencer culture thing that we're trying to examine is that we're in the middle of it. Like, you know how you can only properly historically assess something on the other side?
Sure.
And since we're so in the middle of it and it's such a volatile, unpredictable thing right now, I don't know that I have any answers to really come out with a takeaway, a work takeaway on this situation beyond the basic business principles of scale and preparation and all of that, because I'm not prepared to say I don't. Of course, you and I think, like, if I can speak for you and you tell me if I can't, I don't completely write off influencer culture and the rise of the influencer.
Well, look, I'm going to be a real asshole and say if we do, we have to write ourselves off.
Sure.
You and I live our lives on the internet and our livelihoods on the internet.
Yep.
And part of that means that some of this applies.
Yep. Many people do it very well. Mm-hmm. Very, very well. So it's not like the whole thing can be painted with one brush. These two particular incidents, one on a much smaller scale and one like in the most spectacular way, I there is a connection there, but there's also a disconnect for me too. And let me try and explain. With Fyre Festival, we now know, as people have characterized it, that it was a giant fraud.
It was a scam to begin with.
That was a scam. Although they'll try to deny it, Ja Rule is trying to deny it, that it wasn't a scam. In the end, people were not given correct information and they were misled deliberately and it was a fraud, okay?
Yeah, and yeah. I guess just to put a finer point on it, the signs were there. Like to use a term of yours, the documentary has the receipts all the way through that it was, they knew it was going to be a disaster. It was not a shock.
Yeah.
It's not a freak storm.
Yes, right. With the Caroline Calloway situation, I personally am not prepared to say that it was a fraud of intent from the very beginning. This is somebody who had an idea, eventually realized that she wasn't capable of delivering on that idea, was scrambling to try, and then also, in her way, was documenting her attempts at staying above water. Here are all these mason jars in my house. I'm trying to make all these salads as a way to prove authenticity. Do you know what I mean? How authenticity has become a slogan? Here's how real I am. I'm trying to do this party and I'm so real. I'm showing you how hard it is and how I'm stumbling and fumbling, but I'm going to get it done. This is so real, which in a way it was real. She was stumbling and fumbling, but the authenticity then becomes an excuse for incompetence.
Well, it's defensive, right?
Right. And so here's my disconnect, because we have tried to, like, over the course of this podcast, we've talked about authenticity and being real with your followers and showing them who you are. And yet, what I'm struggling with right now, where I can't find anything neat to leave with, is that authenticity in Caroline Calloway. There was no authenticity with Fyre, but the authenticity that we were hoping from with Fyre sort of existed with Caroline, but it was like almost a misdirect.
Yeah, it's a Band-Aid. Like, I'm not trying to criticize a 25-year-old who got in over their head either. But I come back to the same thing, which is when the authenticity is authentic, you don't have to try so hard to prove it. You know what I keep thinking about? Those childhood videos of Ariana Grande singing, you know, that float around every now and again when she's 5 or 7 or whatever, and you're like, shit, listen to that little kid. Or Alessia Cara in her closet. There are all those videos, right? They were already doing the thing that they ultimately wound up selling to you, that you ultimately wound up paying money for. There was already proof that that was accomplishable. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Chrissy Teigen is another one. Chrissy Teigen, who, you know, people love or hate on social media, and for sure is an influencer.
Mm-hmm.
But Chrissy Teigen was doing two things, making faces and cooking, before she was ever Chrissy Teigen influencer. So I keep coming back to, like, where are the piles and piles and piles of times when you were doing this when nobody was watching?
Mm-hmm.
Where are the things where, like, where's Billy McFarlane, like, doing a shitty battle of the bands in his hometown when he was 16. Where are the things that show me that you've always been this person.
Right.
To me, that's the difference, mm-hmm. I think. And I think that actually can circle back to your girl Gwyneth as well, because I don't think that there are receipts for decades worth of vagina steaming. I think it was just things that sounded good, mm-hmm. but more interesting than kale and organics. I don't know if that's a neat bow either.
No, but you've led me to a place where I think this is a good place to end, which is there is an influencer I met today
mm-hmm.
who is doing a great job. And his name is Dante Colley. Many of you have likely been watching his videos over the last few weeks on Instagram. He's the one, for those of you who don't know, we will link to his Instagram in the show notes. He's the one who makes these amazingly choreographed videos, dance videos of himself, where he sends messages of joy and affirmation to his followers. You are worth it.
Right.
You are going to have a great day.
Yep.
You are amazing. This year is for you. And then like graphics and rainbows and doves and smiley faces shoot out of his fingers and feet and sometimes his ass when he's dancing. And it makes people so happy. Now, he has been doing this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He really only took off in December of 2018. And now he's been on Busy Tonight. We interviewed him. I interviewed him for E! Chalk Today. It will air like the day that this podcast gets posted, which is also when he'll be on Good Morning America.
Amazing.
Now, when I was speaking to him, I asked him about his process for videos. To go back to your point about doing it for a long time before, he's always been dancing. His inspiration, by the way, is That's So Raven.
Perfect.
He watched That's So Raven growing up. He loves dancing, and he's also in digital design and communication and graphics. So these are his worlds. So what he does is he feels like putting together a choreographed routine, finds a song that moves him. And then afterwards, after he does his performance, he'll sit at his computer and he will apply his technical knowledge to the clip, the emojis, the graphics. And all of it is done in a way that's not, it doesn't look overproduced, it's produced.
Sure, but this is his vibe, yes. is to make it look a little raw.
It makes a little an organic,
yeah.
So to speak. And yet you feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been gaining more and more followers and has become, at 21 years old from Toronto, one of the most exciting influencers and personalities on Instagram. He still has to finish school.
Right.
He's getting lots of opportunities. But to your point about doing it for a long time or doing what you've always done, this is what we ask of Dante, or people who follow him have come to ask, is he makes you happy with these videos, and he understands that.
Right, and he can continue to do that on
yep.
a bigger and bigger scale because
yep.
he's doing the thing that he knows how to do.
And I'll tell you what he knew how to do. On E! Talk, we gave him the E! Talk theme music.
Right.
And we asked him in advance to come up with a dance choreographed to it. Well, of course, Dante arrived prepared. Right? Prepared, like, for all the moves, prepared for how the camera should shoot him. I mean, this was the level of work that I saw from this young influencer that made me think, well, this is how you do it. How do you scale it? Well, you're scaling it with Good Morning America, but essentially you are doing the thing that you know.
That's right. So a story that has been floating around our desks for the past couple of weeks is about Frankie Shaw, who is the star and also the showrunner of Smilf, which airs on Showtime. So the show is going into its second season right now, and there have been a series of complaints about Shaw as showrunner, that she was unsympathetic and critical to people who complained, that she separated writers arguably based on race, and that the writers didn't get the credits that they deserve. And most damningly, the issue that's gotten the most headlines is that she mishandled a sex scene or a series of sex scenes, which is making actress Samara Weaving actually leave the show. And we've talked before about how if somebody leaves a show and they're not being removed, it's usually because the situation is untenable. So this is interesting on a number of levels because SMILF, the show, has a lot of kind of high-profile people around it, and Frankie Shaw is quite inexperienced, as she would say herself. And I'm very curious about your take on how we feel about this, whether somebody who is new in this high-profile situation, it's not that different from our previous story, actually, mm-hmm. whether somebody who's this new should be given more chances or not, whether somebody who is this inexperienced or has performed, you know, poorly mm-hmm. Gets another chance or should be coached or what the situation is. And I think it's particularly fraught because we're talking about a female showrunner and because especially in the case of the sex scenes with Samara Weaving, that she was arguably mistreating a fellow actress as well yeah. as another woman.
Well, when I was looking into the situation and it's been unfolding over the last few weeks, the details that I read were that Samara raised her concerns. She thought that they were dealt with. Supposedly, allegedly, when Frankie heard about her concerns, she supposedly decided to override them and do it her way anyway. And her way was the way that was making Samara uncomfortable, specifically related to sex scenes,
right.
nakedness, and intimacy.
Right. Those are all, I think those are details that have been reported and verified.
That's right.
Yeah. Basically, after a couple of sex scenes that were not maybe handled the way Weaving would have liked, that could have been avoided with the intimacy coordinator that we talked about a few episodes ago.
Yeah.
She spoke to the team and to, I would assume, Frankie Shaw herself and said, look, can we have a closed set? Can we have this and that kind of thing? So a closed set is exactly what it sounds like when there's an intimate situation. It's only the people who are there who absolutely have to be there, which means if you are, oh, say, lighting or props or whatever, you do what you need to do. And unlike any other set where you stand around watching the scene, you leave. Mm-hmm. And crucially in this case, she asked for the monitors to be turned off. So monitors are often in many places on a set, but specifically at a location called Video Village, which is where the director and big producers or writers or whatnot, depending on the set, will go to watch what's going on. And you can see several cameras, so you can see what's happening from every angle. And one of the things that Weaving was asking for was for her sex scene not to be essentially broadcast in rough cut to or in raw form to an entire warehouse full of people. And yeah, that was one of the things that Frankie yeah. Shaw violated when she, I think, had been elsewhere, maybe in the writer's room or yeah. working on something else, and came in and said, why are these monitors off, and turned them back on, mm-hmm. despite having had that conversation.
That's right.
And I think it's worth noting that one of the people who had complained about the behavior in the first place, or at least made Showtime executives aware of it, was Rosie O'Donnell, who plays Frankie Shaw's mother on the show.
Right.
And she seems to have come together with her now in solidarity. Like she appeared on the Today Show with her.
Yeah.
But, that's somebody who, to go back to our conversation about experience, has been on a bajillion sets mm-hmm. and a bajillion situations and, you know, felt strongly enough about it to make a phone call and being like, hey, this is not okay.
Well, Rosie's a good place to start, or at least that Today interview is a good place to start because, as you mentioned, Frankie and Rosie were on the Today Show and they were asked, or Frankie was asked, to address the situation and the allegations. And her response was, I've learned a lot. I made mistakes and we're going to move forward. We had a 50% female crew and cast. It was like the equality that everybody's aiming for, but, you know, we can always do better. So that was the for lack of a better word, the apology tour, or a stop on the apology tour.
Mm-hmm.
If we're, you know, lately a lot of people are going on apology tours.
Yeah, it seems to be a new standard, right?
So I think that this is, as you use the word fraught, and I agree, that's a great word, because here's the thing. The one of the solutions that has been proposed and that we believe in is these things will happen less and less when more women are on set.
Right.
And when more women are in leadership positions.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it did work out that way, because someone like Rosie O'Donnell, with that experience as a woman, was able to step up, or did step up, and use her clout and be like, hey, this isn't cool.
Well, and, you know, when Samara Weaving complained and then left, it was a news story. It wasn't just brushed under the rug. We know about this. We know why. You're right, because even though the perpetrator of the problems in this case is a woman, you're right that the whistleblowers were also women and their stories were heard and not just erased.
And clearly, or mostly, they were empowered to do so, to put forward their complaints or, you know, their grievances.
On paper, yeah.
That's right.
I suspect that there's still blowback behind the scenes.
For sure.
But yeah, on paper, we're here, we're talking about it because we know it wasn't a mystery.
But then, of course, how it didn't work is these methods of having more equality on sets, having more women in leadership positions. I mean, the end goal is to eradicate these problems to begin with.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, a problem, and this is thorny too, is that we are talking about somebody who is inexperienced. And I am sure that they could have hired somebody more experienced to run this show. I am sure that it would have been a man. I'm not saying there are not women who are experienced enough to do this job, not by any means. What I am saying is that the United States is in such a scripted television boom that it's a known thing that everybody and their brother is working. Like, everybody is busy, everybody is working, and so it might be that you have to fight to get that person with that gravitas to be there in those moments. It's hard, man. It's hard on lots of levels, because do I a little bit think that she's being excused pretty easily? I kind of do, you know, and I think that this has to do with the fact that, like, let's be real, she stars on the show, so she's cute, she's white, she's young, that people are predisposed to forgive.
Yeah.
You know, you talked about the apology tour, and she also went on Seth Meyers, and Seth says, you know, at no point in show business is there a management meeting. No one ever teaches you how to be a manager. I hope all networks just take this as an opportunity to be like, oh, we have to make sure people who are in charge understand that responsibility. Which, on the one hand, is true. There are no management best practices for running a television show.
Which we've discussed. Who was the showrunner who used to be a hospital administrator?
Glenn Mazzara.
It's probably been a year since we did that episode, and we talked about how he talked about the way that he manages on sets and in show business is thanks to his experience in management outside of the industry.
And look, just as a sidebar, if there's anybody that we talk about who's not quite a household name that you should look into, Glenn Mazzara is that guy. He is actually walking the walk in terms of equality, in trying to find out how to make things better for women on sets, and trying to make his scripts representative of what things are actually like or could be like. Just spare yourself a Google for him. It's worth it. But you're absolutely right that that kind of experience elsewhere is what can make the difference for you.
Yeah. And so to go back to Frankie, as Seth was saying, there's nothing in showbiz that prepares you for management, right? Like, essentially, it's creatives who get elevated to management roles while still being creative. And Frankly, management requires some experience. So here's the situation we find Frankie in. Again, this is tangled and fraught and shitty because we want more Frankies. Like, we want creatives to be showrunners, like, 100%. Who are women.
And I should say that I believe Frankie Shaw created this show with two quite experienced writers who are a writing team, Gene Stupnitsky and Lee Eisenberg. But they are experienced and successful, so they went off to do other projects that they were working on, weren't necessarily there every day. Mm-hmm. That, you know, these are situations where there's only so much you can do. What's interesting to me, actually, is that the one place I would say that there is a management training, or that the person who might disagree with us, is Tina Fey has often talked about how Lorne Michaels taught her management, that she learned management at Saturday Night Live, not being a performer, but being the head writer, needing all the other writers to do what she needed them to do, and that kind of thing. And, you know, I don't know if the sets of her shows are happy, well-run places, but I have a feeling they are, that they're efficient and proper and, you know, not causing people to step over boundaries that make them uncomfortable.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because we've talked many times, for all of its problems, that Saturday Night Live is a training ground, like a lab, right?
Yeah.
That when you go there, there are times when you're unhappy. You know, Bill Hader has talked about how he's unhappy. But by and large, the people who succeed there stay for a number of years. And so there's a muscle, there's a training, there's a certain discipline that is picked up, that's honed, that's then taken away and applied to other areas. And I'm not saying everybody from there walks away with management experience, but Tina did, and certainly Seth.
I'm sure Seth Meyers would say the same, or Amy Poehler, or lots of those people.
Even maybe Jimmy Fallon, you know what I mean?
For sure. And so, here's the thing, though, about those shows, and we've talked about this a lot in general, that a show like a Seth Meyers or a Jimmy Fallon or whatnot is every day. You're practicing all the time. You have more and more at-bats to get it right. And Saturday Night Live, while it's new every week, is also 42 years old. There are structures and rules and things that you work within. And that's what you absolutely don't have on the first season of a cable show run by a new creator. Everything is new. There are no patterns. There are no rules yet.
Well, here's where I'm going to connect this story with the previous one, and that's scale. And in a larger sense, I think in every industry, but we'll focus right now on show business, on scripted, is that, as you said, everything is getting made all at once. Mm-hmm. More and more demand. Nobody is available because everybody is working. And everybody has to work at a greater speed and pace that I think they used to have to work at.
Absolutely, that is true.
So what's being lost is we have the scale. But what's being lost is what has to support scale, which is preparation and training. And to take it bigger, I think that is the same in every industry, be it in marketing, be it in engineering, whatever your industry might be, things need to be done faster at a bigger rate, and people aren't getting the time they need to fuck up in small areas. So their fuck ups come
in private. You want to make your mistakes in private.
That's right. Or on a project that's not going to set people back a year.
Yes.
You know, and so the fuck ups happen on a fire festival level. The fuck ups happen when you're the showrunner and you lose a cast member. Again, I don't know the way around this, because it's not slowing down. The speed is crazy.
Well, I think this is going to be one of those situations where we have a hard kind of lesson here, which is it can be like, be careful what you wish for. It can be a problem to get what you want too soon. Like, you should want to get out from under somebody else. You should feel that thing of working with somebody and you think that they are the sun and the moon. You know, when you first have a boss who's also your inspiration?
Like a professional crush too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like somewhere between 13 going on 30 and Miranda Priestley and whatnot.
Yep.
And you think they are amazing.
Yeah.
And then you really get into doing it and everything's going really well and you are partners, you are matching. And then comes a day where you're like, I don't know if I would have done it that way. And then maybe a series of days. And then, like, it should be a long period of time where you are thinking about, wow, I think maybe I would do this differently.
Yeah.
Before you think, well, maybe I'm ready.
Yeah.
I think that only when you've, you know, we sort of brush past all these idioms about training and work about like, oh, well, when you've sucked up everything you can, when you this or that, and I hate to assign this to young people, but you're right. Maybe it's demographics, maybe because baby boomers are retiring, I don't know. People now think, well, I've learned everything I can. I've made my mistakes in the span of 6 months. And you're going, but you haven't. And it's not because everybody wants to keep you down that people are saying, no, 6 months is not long enough. It's because, yeah, everybody wants for you to make your mistakes in private, like on a test exercise. It's a hard thing to tell to anybody, especially if the alternative is that there's a network being like, yeah, make your show. You're amazing. Go for it. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. And I don't know what makes the difference between somebody who, people who are relatively young who have a good go of it.
Yeah.
And those who don't, because we know they probably had roughly the same training, which is to say not that much.
Yeah, I mean, so to answer your original question, what do we think about Frankie Shaw's second chance? I don't know that I have an answer other than to say that, like, our answer was just like a deep dive on scale again and the consequences of it with lack of preparation and experience.
Yeah, I guess it becomes a cautionary tale. If you don't want to be this person, check and check and check yourself. And if and when somebody says to you, oh, maybe you can have somebody to oversee you and help you out, don't be too quick to say, oh, I'm good. I'm fine. That would be my error for sure. I'd be like, I got this. I'm good.
Yeah.
And I would live to rue the day. So maybe just check yourself before you spread those wings.
Probably a good lesson for all of us.
I really am feeling like an elder today.
Well, speaking of elders,
somebody who can tell us exactly how it's done.
Samuel L. Jackson.
Now, you brought me this article and you said, oh, we should do this. And the headline or the peg is that he is now Hollywood's most bankable star.
Right. He's in basically all the movies that make a shitload of money, including all the Marvel Avengers movies, which is like a lot of money.
But as we talked about earlier, there's no insurance, there's no guarantees, and there's nothing in this piece that is about why he's the most bankable. What is clear in this piece is why he's the most enjoyable.
That's right. And like they try and get there, how Samuel L. Jackson became Hollywood's most bankable star. And the thing is that, yeah, it is a chronicling of his career, his start, his stumbles, and his recovery in more ways than one. But it's also, to me, about a certain attitude. And I don't know that it's an attitude that, sure, you can only have this when you're 70 and you actually are Hollywood's most bankable star. Or if it's the attitude that got him to become Hollywood's most bankable star. And that attitude, well, there's a couple of things that go into this. There's one part in the article where he talked about how suddenly Hollywood started calling.
Right.
And quote, he says, that was pretty much the end of me beating the pavement in New York. A slew of film roles started coming his way. They list the roles. For those early parts, he was never the first choice. Quote, every script had shit, Forrest Whitaker, Denzel, Larry Fishburne's fingerprints, he recalls. But he was thrilled to have a seat at the table. He was also earning big paychecks. I got to Hollywood at the right time, when the second fiddle check was better than the leading man check is now. Hollywood was just throwing money at movies. And yeah, there's some truth there about money and how they get less money now. But what he's saying is, I was taking parts that were rejected.
Absolutely.
By these people.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't give a fuck.
Why should he?
I like the money.
Yeah.
And what's funny is that he's made really bad movies.
Oh, for sure.
You know how we make fun of a lot of actors who take really bad movies? Like, for example, Nicolas Cage is one of those where it's become a punchline now. Like, you say something ridiculous and someone says, that sounds like the plot of a Nick Cage movie. No one really makes fun of Sam Jackson for that. Even in shitty movies, he somehow manages to be cool and, I don't know, I don't want to say Teflon because that's not what this is about. It's not like he doesn't wear it. It's just, and it's not like we don't expect like a high level of performance from him because we know he's an excellent, outstanding performer. It's just, well, you tell me, why don't we have those conversations with Sam Jackson?
I think it comes back to what you were starting to say earlier about attitude. He says somewhere in this piece, he talks about how, you know, he doesn't always see some of the same people he did before. And he says, well, it's true what they say about success. You don't change, the people around you change. And I take issue with the idea that he was taking these movies that had everybody else's fingerprints on them because he liked the money. He likes the work. The reason that we don't mock him, or the reason he's not a punchline, is because, very simply, Samuel L. Jackson is having a ball.
Yes, it's fun.
What is my number one rule for award shows?
Have a good time.
If you show up to a televised party in a ball gown, you better goddamn have a good time. I want you to live vicariously for me. And Samuel L. Jackson does that in every role that he plays. Like, I think if we were talking about somebody who is a bit more pretentious, we would say they commit, you know, that he commits to each role.
Yeah.
But he's also kind of halfway winking at you the whole time.
Yeah.
He's having a ball. And I have to interject with a personal Samuel L. Jackson story. I didn't know that I had one, but this is, it's a good story. Years ago, when I was working at ETalk, where you do now, I got a call. I covered a lot of fashion and style, and I got a call for an interview with Samuel L. Jackson at Hugo Boss, right?
Right.
And so we're told, okay, he's going to like look at some clothes, and then you can talk to him. Fine. So you know this. So I show up for the interview expecting that I'm going to have what? How long?
10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Max.
That's a big 10 minutes.
Tops.
Yeah. It was 2 hours and change.
What?
First, he tried on clothes for a long time. Like, I mean, I can't remember what it was that he was promoting in conjunction with
right.
Hugo Boss. But he was trying on clothes and modeling them for us. And he was changing clothes in front of us without going to the change room.
Like this, and it was play-by-play at the same time, right? He was doing the play-by-play.
100%. Or he'd be like, you know, let's go back to the lavender or something. He was just, yeah, he's like, I feel this. I like this. This
yeah.
is good. What do you think? No, this. Okay, let's do the other one. Drops his pants, tighty-whities. I want to be clear. This is not a Me Too situation.
Yeah.
There were 10 people around. He just could not care less.
Yeah.
He was into modeling the clothes and doing things.
And you have this on camera.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This exists somewhere in a tape in
yeah.
your office.
Yeah.
And then, and this is the part that I like the most, then when he sat down to do the interview and we talked about all the things and whatever, and, you know, I will humbly brag that I'm a good interviewer, guys. We were keeping things going. But he was wearing one of the sweaters that he had picked out, and it was kind of like an orange sherbet color.
Yeah.
And he said something about how at this point in his life, he's doing things to make himself happy, or he has to choose things to make himself happy. And he said, like this sweater, you know, it's got this sherbet. It speaks to the chill and it lifts me up. Something like that.
Right.
And my editor, who I was working with, who was cutting the piece with me, said the words speaks to the chill for approximately a year. It was one of the low-key best celebrity experiences I've ever had.
Oh, yeah.
And in case it's not clear, I was having a ball because he was having a ball.
Yes.
It was, I don't know what he was doing. I don't know what they told him. But yeah, okay, spend 2 hours with this, you know, entertainment outlet. And we could have talked about all the things under the sun and did. Whatever he does, he does 100%. He's been able to find the fun and the joy for himself in everything that he does. And I think that's why he's the opposite of a punchline, why he's a legend.
So what do you think about the story then that he tells? Because he is a legend and he can say at this point whatever the fuck he wants.
Right. And I'm just going to underscore the point here. He's having a ball telling all of these stories.
Oh, yeah.
Like every story that's in this piece, and there are several.
It's crackling off the page.
And he's loving it. Yeah. Like there's a point where he talks about how he thought Quentin Tarantino was a shitty actor before he found out he was a director.
Yeah.
Like, amazing.
So he tells the story about Spike Lee, about Jungle Fever premiering in Cannes, and that Spike didn't fly him to the premiere.
Right. Because he could only fly the big stars. Right?
There was no budget for Sam Jackson, who clearly wasn't, in Spike's estimation at the time, a star.
Right. And to be fair, it sounds like he's saying within the movie, right? Like that whoever, I don't know who got top billing, but that he was number 5 or 6 on the call sheet or whatever.
Yeah. And listen, this was, at the time, Hollywood wasn't calling much. Spike put him in the movie.
Right.
Right? I think he had just come out of rehab and he was playing an addict.
Yeah.
And that there were people who were like, are you sure you want to do this? And he was like, fuck yeah. And he did a great job. It was so great that from Cannes, they tell him that his performance was so memorable that they honored it with, quote, the festival's first and only Best Supporting Actor Award. And he says, that day I'm out at an audition and I called my agent and said, did Hollywood call? And she's like, as a matter of fact, they kind of did. Lee has never apologized to Jackson for leaving his breakout star back in the U.S. Not only that, Jackson says, when he came back, he didn't actually give me my goddamn award for like 8 months.
See?
So obviously he's not holding it against him. That role clearly catapulted him. Like, Hollywood is calling. You got this amazing once-in-a-lifetime, literally, award from the Cannes Film Festival. You're going to work. Everything's cool. Spike still didn't fly you out. We don't have to be mad at anybody. Right?
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, what's the... No, you already did the work. As you said, he put you in the movie. You put the performance on film, which caused them to create an award for you. Yeah, what's to be mad at? It's there.
If I were going to interview Spike Lee coming up soon, I would say, hey, I just read this article about Sam in the Hollywood Reporter about, you know, the Cannes Film Festival, said you never apologized. And I imagine Spike Lee being like, why the fuck should I apologize?
Yeah, I made that guy, he would say.
Yeah. But these are the stories, right? Like that only make sense when you look back. I'm sure Spike knew it was an amazing performance. I don't know that Spike knew that it would get a special once-in-a-lifetime award, but I'm pretty sure Spike would have been confident. It's his movie, after all.
Yeah, but even then, how can you be mad at that? Even if you're Spike Lee and you don't expect that, how can you be mad that the guy you chose to put in your movie got a special award? You're like, even if you're annoyed, you're like, well, I guess I can pick him.
I'm a genius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what this comes down to, and this is alchemy, you can't make this up, but Samuel L. Jackson either has always known who he is, or he made a real effort to get to be comfortable with who he is, right? There is no pretense. There's no illusion. He'll stand in front of strangers in his tidy whities in between cashmere sweaters.
Yeah.
He is not pretending for anybody. And that's what's so alluring. That's why people will see him in anything and love him in anything, is that he's not striving to be anything other than what he is. The only striving we hear of in this whole piece is what he was striving for Hollywood to call. He wanted to get there. And now he's there and he's not going to be mad at it.
So you know who, well, let me tell you the sort of genesis of this. When I pitched this to you, one of the things I thought I wanted to end on, and probably we can end on this, so I was going to say, is there going to be anyone else like this? Bankable, who took the roles that got passed over, who can have this kind of attitude. And I was stumped for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I came up with it. Okay. Should I put you out of your misery? Or do you have somebody in your mind?
I don't. And I'm wondering if just the way you're talking, I feel as though there should be like three contenders. But anyway, go on.
I only have one, but I would love to invite people to like give us options mm-hmm. as not homework, but this is more like fun game. I think that, you know who else has some of this? Is Sandra Oh.
Right. Has always been Sandra Oh.
Yeah.
Has been waiting to be seen as Sandra Oh.
Yeah.
And now that people are finally appreciating Sandra Oh.
Yeah.
Is going to continue to be Sandra Oh.
That's right. You know what brought me to this, though? She hosted the Golden Globes with Andy Samberg.
Mm-hmm.
And it is de rigueur to watch an award show and dump on something. Dump on someone.
You mean make somebody or something the punchline?
Yeah. Or like, I didn't like her. I didn't like him.
Right.
Wasn't funny. Or put the blame on the host or hosts or whatever.
Right.
No complaints about Sandra Oh. Like, have you come across anything negative about Sandra Oh?
No, I haven't.
Not her jokes, not her parents, not her winning, not her speeches, not her earnestness.
Nobody can criticize any of that. And as you say, she's sort of her own package, right? She's been leaving it all on the floor since long before Grey's Anatomy, as
yeah.
Canadians who know indie film will tell you. But yeah, she's been being Sandra Oh.
Yeah.
She didn't make any missteps that night because it wasn't her first time out being Sandra Oh.
Yeah. But she's got that Sam Jackson thing where, like, even if she were going to be in something shitty, it wouldn't be like, oh, Sandra Oh was in something shitty, boo, boo, boo. Just like Sam Jackson. She's having a good time.
She's having a great time, and she doesn't have any insecurity about doing it.
No.
I love that. But I have to say, I thought and I hoped that maybe you were going to have somebody slightly younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a suggestion, but I have a reason for that need.
Okay.
And it's my favorite anecdote in the whole piece. I'm sure you can guess.
Yeah.
The reporter's talking to Samuel L. Jackson about how he's such a legend that now he is even the subject of scripts on The Blacklist, which is the
yes.
biggest unproduced scripts. Not scripts that are written for him.
Yeah.
But in this case, there's a log line for a script that says, during segregation in the 1960s American South, a nerdy teen tries to win a student election at an all-black high school, but he'll have to defeat a blossoming badass named Samuel L. Jackson to do so. So he tells him this, and Sam Jackson goes, uh-huh, uh-huh. And then they say, oh, and it was written by John Dorsey. And it says, a broad smile crosses Jackson's face. Is that William Dorsey's son, he asks? The answer is yes. That was the guy who ran against me for student body president. Like, his legend continues. Now, he does go on to say, but I was the nerdy team and he was the cool guy. But when asked who won the election, I did, Jackson says, still smiling. This is the kind of person who has had this impact on people since he was, did it say middle school? Since he was 12 years old.
Yeah.
So somebody needs to be coming up with enough swagger to play that. But I love that Sandra Oh is in the immediate, the heir apparent, because I can't think of anybody better.
You guys tell us who in your mind could be that.
The exquisite, don't give a fuck, and joy at the same time. That's what we're looking to nail down here. And on that note, this week apparently was all about listening to those who know better and checking yourself. So let us know how that resonates for you, what you've been doing in that way, and how you want to do that going forward.
Keep sending us your notes about your work and keep sending us your suggestions. A lot of you were suggesting to us and asking that we cover Fyre Festival this week, and we felt like we had to.
And a lot of you have sent other ideas that are actually in the hopper for upcoming shows. We can't tell you too much yet, but suffice it to say, your voices are definitely being heard. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Leave comments, leave reviews. We love that. We need that. And until next time, work hard.
Bye. Show your work.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.